A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those prompts where I read it and thought, yeah, I've been in that exact kitchen. He's got an 11-month-old in part-time daycare, and when the little guy's home, he finds himself walking circles around the kitchen while sending in prompts or listening to this podcast. The baby seems perfectly content, but Daniel's standing there wondering, is this painfully boring for him? At this age, the Pediatric Association says no screens, so what are you supposed to do? He's asking about three things specifically: taking them out of the house, playing with safe toys, and making sure their day-to-day experience isn't tedious, even if the parent is bored stiff.
This is one of those questions where the guilt is doing way more work than the actual developmental problem. The guilt spiral here. I'm walking in circles, my baby's just staring at cabinets, I should be doing more. That guilt is a completely real feeling, but it's built on a premise about infant brains that's basically backwards. The fear that a baby is bored is almost always a projection of adult boredom onto a brain that doesn't experience boredom the way we do.
The baby's not bored, but I, or Daniel, or anyone in that kitchen, definitely is.
And that's the thing we need to separate out. The parent's experience of tedium is real and valid. Walking in circles in a kitchen for 20 minutes is not intellectually stimulating for an adult. But the question of whether the baby is bored is a totally different question, and the neuroscience here is genuinely fascinating.
Let's get into that neuroscience, because I think that's where the relief is hiding. What's actually happening in an 11-month-old brain when they're staring at the same kitchen cabinets for the 15th time?
The core concept here is what developmental researchers call the boredom gap, or more accurately, the habituation gap. Adult brains have mature prefrontal cortices that are incredibly efficient at pattern recognition. We walk into a kitchen, we see cabinets, we've seen cabinets 10,000 times, our brain essentially says cabinets, noted, moving on within about 2 to 3 seconds. We habituate almost instantly.
The baby doesn't.
The baby's prefrontal cortex at 11 months is nowhere near mature. The myelination isn't complete. The neural pathways that allow for rapid habituation aren't online yet. So every single time that baby passes the cabinet, they are processing it with something much closer to fresh attention. The grain of the wood, the way light hits the handle, the slight variation in angle as they're carried past it, it's all novel data.
It's not that the baby is bored by repetition. It's that the baby is incapable of being bored by repetition in the way we are.
And there's a really elegant study that demonstrates this. The visual expectation paradigm work originally done by Marshall Haith in the late 90s, but it's been replicated with modern eye tracking and neuroimaging. The University of Iowa did a study just last year using functional near-infrared spectroscopy, FNIRS, where they showed 11-month-olds the same video sequence 10 times in a row. Neural activation didn't drop off. It actually increased on repetitions 4 through 7, peaking when the babies could predict what was coming next. The brain was more engaged once it had built a predictive model of the stimulus, not less. It's the opposite of adult boredom.
The baby's brain is basically saying, I know what's coming, and I am deeply satisfied that I was right.
That's not a bad summary. And this connects to something fundamental about infant cognition that gets lost in the enrichment panic. The baby's brain doesn't primarily need novelty, it needs contingency.
Define contingency in this context.
Contingency means my action produces a predictable response. When the baby babbles and the parent babbles back, that's contingency. When the baby drops a spoon and it clatters on the floor every single time, that's contingency. When they reach toward a cabinet handle and the parent says, that's the cabinet where we keep the plates, contingency. The brain is building causal models of the world, and predictability is the raw material for that construction.
The kitchen walk, where the baby sees the same cabinets, but the parent is responding to their babble, pointing things out occasionally, making eye contact. That's actually a richer developmental environment than a brand new toy the baby can't control.
Right. And this is where the research gets really interesting. The Lena Foundation, they're the organization that does naturalistic language recordings in homes, released a major study in 2024 that tracked language environments in hundreds of homes with 11-month-olds. The finding that jumped out was that kids in homes where they heard 30-plus adult words per minute had twice the language processing speed at 24 months. And here's the key. This had nothing to do with environmental novelty. It didn't matter whether those words happened in a kitchen, a park, or a museum. What mattered was the density of contingent verbal interaction.
You don't need to be in an interesting place. You need to be an interesting conversationalist, even if the conversation is completely one-sided.
The baby thinks it's two-sided, and that's what matters. When an 11-month-old babbles and you respond, even if your response is, "Are you serious? Tell me more about that cabinet," their brain is registering a successful social transaction. They initiated, you responded, the world makes sense.
This reframes the whole guilt thing pretty dramatically. The parent who's walking in circles, half listening to a podcast, occasionally responding to the baby's babble. They're not failing. They're hitting the developmental sweet spot.
They absolutely are. And I want to be really clear here. I'm not saying this to make anyone feel better. I'm saying it because the data says it. The Harvard Center on the Developing Child published a study earlier this year that actually compared what they called high enrichment environments to low variety, high contingency environments.
What did they find?
The high enrichment group, these were 11-month-olds with multiple toys rotated hourly, daily outings to different venues, structured enrichment activities, actually showed elevated cortisol levels and shorter attention spans compared to the low variety group, where the babies had fewer toys and less environmental novelty but more responsive caregiver interaction.
So the enrichment was stressing them out.
The researchers' interpretation was that too much novelty without enough predictability overwhelms the infant stress regulation system. The baby's brain is trying to build stable models of the world, and if the world keeps changing too fast, it can't. It's like trying to learn the rules of chess when someone keeps swapping out the pieces.
The enrichment industrial complex, the baby classes, the subscription toy boxes, the developmental activity schedules might actually be counterproductive.
I'd say it's more nuanced than that. Some babies enjoy novel environments, and some parents enjoy providing them. The problem isn't enrichment activities per se. The problem is the guilt-driven assumption that more enrichment equals better development and that without it, you're failing your child. The data doesn't support that. What it supports is that contingent, responsive interaction in whatever environment you happen to be in is the thing that drives development.
Let's anchor this back to the specific scenario. Daniel's walking in circles in his kitchen. The baby's being carried. What's actually happening for that baby, sensorimotor-wise?
This is where it gets fun, because the kitchen walk is actually a rich multisensory experience that the parent is completely discounting. Let me break it down. First, there's vestibular stimulation. The baby's being carried, so their inner ear is getting constant input about motion, balance, and spatial orientation. The vestibular system is hugely important for development at this age, and it's being stimulated for free just by the act of walking.
Free vestibular training.
Second, visual tracking. The baby is moving through space while objects stay fixed, which means they're practicing smooth pursuit eye movements and depth perception. Every time they pass a cabinet, the visual angle changes slightly. Their brain is doing trigonometry.
The baby's doing trigonometry while I'm listening to a podcast about AI. That feels unfair.
Third, auditory patterns. The rhythm of footsteps, the parent's voice, the hum of the refrigerator. These are consistent auditory anchors that help the baby build temporal expectations. Fourth, proprioceptive input. If the baby's being held, they're getting constant feedback about where their body is in space relative to the parent's body. This is the stuff that occupational therapists actively try to provide for kids with sensory processing issues, and it's happening for free in a kitchen walk.
When I'm walking in circles feeling guilty, my baby is actually in a sensory integration masterclass.
The guilt is the only thing that's not serving anyone.
All right, so we've established that your baby's brain is actually thriving on that kitchen tour. But let's get specific about what happens when you actually leave the house. That brings us to the first pillar from the prompt, outings.
Here's where the conventional wisdom gets it wrong. Most parents think about outings in terms of destination quality. Is this place enriching enough? Is it a museum? A baby music class? and the implication is that a trip to the grocery store is somehow a developmental failure because it's not a dedicated enrichment activity.
The grocery store as a guilt trigger.
But if you actually look at the sensory profile of a grocery store versus a baby gym, the grocery store wins on almost every dimension. The UC Berkeley Infant Cognition Lab did a study in 2023 where they tracked sustained attention in 11-month-olds during different types of outings. The finding was that babies showed greater sustained attention during routine errands than during enrichment activities. Because enrichment activities are designed for babies, which means they're predictable and sanitized, a baby gym has soft edges, primary colors, and objects designed to be grabbed by infant hands. A grocery store has produce with unpredictable textures, fluorescent lighting that changes as you move through the store, strangers' faces at varying distances, temperature shifts in the refrigerated section, the vibration of the shopping cart.
The free samples lady who thinks your baby is adorable?
Social interaction with a novel adult who makes exaggerated facial expressions. That's gold for an 11-month-old. And the cart itself is a vestibular stimulation device. You're pushing them through space, they're getting visual flow, they're hearing a cacophony of voices and beeping scanners and rattling wheels.
The errand that the parent sees as a chore to get through is actually the richest sensory environment the baby will experience all week.
The parent doesn't have to do anything extra. They don't have to narrate the produce section or create learning moments. The environment is doing the work. The baby's brain is self-serve. It will take what it needs from the environment as long as the environment is sufficiently varied and the baby feels safe.
The safety piece seems important. If the baby's overwhelmed, none of this works.
That's the attachment piece. The baby needs to know the caregiver is available as a secure base. In attachment theory terms, the baby uses the parent as a reference point. They'll explore the environment, check back in visually, and return to the parent if something's too intense. As long as that loop is working, the environment can be as stimulating as it wants to be.
The grocery store works because the baby is strapped into a cart 3 inches from the parent, getting tons of sensory input with the option to bury their face in the parent's chest if the lobster tank gets too real.
And compare that to a baby music class where the parent might feel pressure to facilitate the baby's engagement. Look at the shaker, Sweetie, Shake the Shaker, which actually interrupts the baby's own attentional processes. The baby was perfectly happy staring at the other baby across the circle, and now they're being redirected to a shaker they didn't choose.
The parent as attentional backseat driver.
There's a really nice concept from occupational therapy called looping that applies here. Looping is when you repeat the same activity with one small variation each time. So instead of taking the baby to a new place every day, you take them to the same grocery store every Tuesday, but you go at a slightly different time, or you take a different route through the aisles, or you let them hold a different piece of produce at the checkout.
The routine provides the safety, and the micro variation provides the novelty.
The baby's brain gets to do what it's built to do, detect the variation against the stable background. That's literally what the predictive processing models of cognition suggest is happening. The brain is constantly generating predictions and then noting the prediction errors. If the environment is too chaotic, there's no stable prediction to generate. If it's too monotonous, there are no errors to learn from.
The Goldilocks zone of infant cognition.
Which is basically the updated version of Vygotsky's zone of proximal development. Vygotsky said kids learn best when the challenge is just beyond their current ability. The modern version, applied to infant attention, says they attend best when the environment is just slightly less predictable than they expect. The grocery store on a Tuesday morning hits that sweet spot. It's familiar enough to be predictable, chaotic enough to be interesting.
Now, if outings are about the external world, toys are about the internal world. What the baby does with objects when they're in control. And this is where most parents get it wrong.
Let me guess what the typical 11-month-old's toy situation looks like in a lot of homes. There's a playmat with dangling objects, a light-up musical activity table, a few electronic toys that make animal sounds when you press buttons, maybe some stacking rings, and a basket of stuffed animals.
The baby plays with the remote control and an empty water bottle.
And there's a reason for that. The remote control and the water bottle are open-ended objects. They don't tell the baby what to do with them. The baby has to impose structure on the object, which is cognitively demanding in exactly the right way.
Whereas the light-up musical toy imposes its structure on the baby.
The electronic toy says, "Press this button and I will play a song." The baby presses the button, the song plays, cause and effect is demonstrated, and then, what? The toy has done its one thing. The water bottle, on the other hand, can be rolled, chewed, banged, dropped, peeked through, filled with smaller objects, used as a telescope.
The water bottle is a platform. The electronic toy is an appliance.
There's a study from Developmental Science in 2024 that quantified this difference. They had 11-month-olds play with either simple blocks or electronic light-up musical toys, and they measured vocalizations per minute. The kids with the blocks had 40% more vocalizations.
40% more? That's not subtle.
It's not. And the researchers' interpretation was that the open-ended toys required the baby to generate their own narrative, which prompted more social referencing and vocalization. The electronic toys did the narrating for them, so the baby went quiet and just received input.
The toy that seems more educational, lights, music, numbers, and a cheerful voice, is actually doing less for language development than a wooden spoon.
The wooden spoon is a masterpiece of open-ended design. It's a drumstick, a teether, a reaching tool, a stirring implement, a thing to bang on different surfaces to compare sounds. And it costs nothing, and you already have 5 of them.
This connects to something I've noticed about the baby product market. The more a toy advertises its educational benefits, the less likely it is to provide them.
There's a term for this in developmental psychology. It's called the educational toy paradox, though that's a bit of an informal label. The basic idea is that toys designed to teach specific skills often bypass the cognitive processes that actually build those skills. A toy that says, "The red square goes in the red hole," is doing the problem solving for the baby. A set of wooden blocks of different shapes just sits there, and the baby has to figure out what to do with them.
Which is harder and better.
Which is harder and better. And this is where the optimal mismatch theory comes back in. The baby needs a challenge that's just slightly beyond their current ability. An electronic toy that does everything when you press a button is below their ability. It's too easy. A set of blocks they can't quite stack yet is right in the zone.
What's the ideal toy lineup for an 11-month-old? If you were curating a toy box,
I'd say the principle is objects that respond to the baby's actions in varied and predictable ways. Wooden spoons, plastic measuring cups, fabric scraps of different textures, a cardboard box, a set of simple wooden blocks, a ball that rolls in interesting ways, a mirror they can't break, and maybe one or two captivating objects, things with an interesting visual or tactile property that you rotate in and out.
Rotate in and out. That's important.
The research on toy rotation is pretty consistent. Fewer toys available at any given time leads to longer, deeper engagement with each toy. A study from the University of Toledo a few years back found that toddlers in a playroom with 4 toys played with each toy for twice as long and in more creative ways than toddlers in a room with 16 toys.
The toy box overflowing with options is actually undermining play quality.
It's the paradox of choice for babies. Too many options, and they flit from one to the next without ever going deep on any of them. 4 to 6 toys out at a time, rotated every few days, and most of those toys should be household objects.
Let me push back on something. If the baby's perfectly happy with a wooden spoon, why do parents feel this intense pressure to buy the light-up activity table?
Because the light-up activity table is marketed to the parent, not the baby. The parent sees the lights, hears the cheerful voice counting to 10 in English and Spanish, and thinks, "This is educational." The baby sees a confusing object that does things they can't predict or control.
It's marketing to parental anxiety.
The baby enrichment market is enormous. I was looking at the market data. Baby subscription toy boxes have seen a 34% increase since 2024. That's not because babies suddenly need more toys. It's because parents feel guilty, and these services promise to solve that guilt with a monthly delivery of curated developmental objects.
A 34% increase. So the guilt is literally a growth industry.
The industry is solving a problem that, from a developmental perspective, doesn't exist.
We've covered outings and toys, but the third pillar, the day-to-day experience, is where the rubber meets the road. This is where the parent's boredom becomes the central character.
I think this is the hardest one to talk about, honestly, because there's a taboo around admitting that spending all day with a baby can be mind-numbingly dull.
It absolutely can be. And saying that doesn't mean you don't love your child. It means you have an addled brain that craves addled stimulation.
The prompt gets at this directly, ensuring that their day-to-day experience is fun and not tedious, even if you, the parent, are a bit bored. That's the tension. The parent is bored, and they're projecting that boredom onto the baby, assuming the baby must be bored too.
We've established that the baby isn't bored. So the question becomes, how does the parent manage their own boredom without disrupting the baby's perfectly adequate experience?
This is where I want to introduce the concept of parallel play. In early childhood, parallel play is when two kids play near each other, but not with each other. Each is doing their own thing, but they're aware of the other's presence and occasionally check in. I think the same model works for parent-infant interaction.
The parent is doing their own thing, the baby is doing their own thing, and they're co-present without being co-engaged.
The parent can be listening to a podcast, thinking through a work problem, folding laundry, prepping dinner. The baby is on the floor exploring a wooden spoon and a plastic container. The key is that the parent remains available for what developmental psychologists call bids for attention.
A bid for attention is what? The baby looks up, babbles, reaches toward the parent.
Any signal that says, connect with me. And the research on this is really clear. It's not the quantity of parent engagement that matters, it's the reliability of the response. If the baby makes a bid and the parent responds within a few seconds most of the time, the baby feels secure and returns to independent exploration. If the bids are consistently ignored, the baby escalates or withdraws.
The 20-minute kitchen walk where the parent is listening to this podcast and occasionally responding to the baby's babble. That's not just adequate, it's optimal.
It's optimal because it teaches the baby something crucial. I can explore independently, and when I need connection, it's available. That's the foundation of secure attachment and self-regulation.
If the parent were hovering, narrating everything, constantly trying to engage the baby,
that can actually be intrusive. The baby never gets to practice self-directed attention because the parent keeps redirecting it. There's a really interesting line of research on what happens when parents are overly directive during play. The babies learn to look to the parent for what to do next instead of generating their own ideas.
The bored parent who's half ignoring their baby while listening to a podcast might actually be fostering more independent play than the engaged parent who's providing constant enrichment.
Within reason, yes. And I want to be careful here because I'm not advocating for neglect. The distinction is between being available and being directive. Available means you're present, you're responsive to bids, but you're not orchestrating the baby's experience. Directive means you're controlling the baby's attention. Look at this, do this, try this, which teaches the baby that their own attentional choices aren't valid.
Let's get concrete. What does a good day look like for an 11-month-old with a parent who's trying not to over-engineer things?
I'd structure it around what I'd call predictable variety. The day has a consistent rhythm. Wake up, eat, play, nap, eat, outing, play, nap, eat, bedtime routine, but within each block there are micro variations. Same walk around the block, but you take a different street. Same kitchen play, but today you give them a whisk instead of a wooden spoon. Same grocery store, but you let them hold a lemon at the checkout.
The routine is the container. The variations are the spice.
The parent's job is to maintain the container, notice the baby's cues, and respond to bids. That's it. They don't need to be the entertainment director.
There's something liberating about this framework, but I can also imagine a parent hearing it and thinking, okay, but what do I actually do all day, like hour by hour?
Let me sketch out what the research suggests is a developmentally rich day for an 11-month-old. Morning, wake up, feeding with face-to-face interaction. That's natural serve and return. Then independent play on the floor with three or four objects while the parent has coffee and does their own thing nearby. The pair responds to bids but doesn't direct. Mid-morning, an outing. Doesn't matter what, grocery store, walk, post office. The baby gets sensory variety and social observation. Late morning, nap, afternoon, feeding, then another block of independent play, maybe in a different room or with a different set of objects. Late afternoon, a second outing or some parallel activity. Parent preps dinner while baby explores a low kitchen cabinet.
The low kitchen cabinet. That's the kitchen safari.
The kitchen safari is a real thing in occupational therapy circles. You clear out a lower cabinet, put in some safe pots and lids and wooden spoons and plastic containers, and let the baby go to town. The baby gets to open and close the door, take things out, put things in, bang things together, Meanwhile, the parent is 3 feet away chopping vegetables.
The parent doesn't need to narrate or facilitate. The pots are doing the work.
The pots are a STEM curriculum. Weight, sound, cause and effect, object permanence, containment, it's all there. And the baby is in control of their own exploration, which builds executive function skills that are literally the foundation for everything that comes later.
You mentioned a case study in your notes, something about a parent who did this kitchen safari approach and saw independent play duration increase.
Yeah, this was an anecdotal case from an occupational therapist I follow, but the numbers were striking. A parent replaced all scheduled enrichment activities with a daily kitchen safari, just letting the baby explore lower cabinets while the parent prepped dinner. At the start, the baby's independent play lasted about 4 minutes before they sought the parent. After 3 weeks of this daily routine, independent play duration had increased to 18 minutes.
From 4 minutes to 18. That's a huge jump.
The mechanism makes sense. The baby learned that independent exploration was safe and rewarding, that the parent was available but not hovering, and that the environment was consistently interesting. They built the neural circuitry for sustained attention through practice.
The parent did less, and the baby did more.
Which might be the single most important principle in infant development that nobody tells you.
Let's talk about the screen thing, because it's the elephant in the room. The American Academy of Pediatrics reaffirmed their zero screens before 18 months guideline in their 2025 position paper. That's a pretty hard line.
It is, and I want to be clear about what the guideline actually says, because it gets misrepresented a lot. The AAP says no screen time before 18 months, with one specific exception, live video calls. FaceTime with grandparents counts as social interaction, not screen time, because it's contingent and responsive.
The distinction is between interactive and passive.
A video call is serve and return. The baby babbles, grandma responds, the baby sees the contingency. A TV show is one way, the baby receives input but can't influence it. And at 11 months, the baby's brain doesn't learn from passive screen input. They can't map what's on the screen to the real world. It's what researchers call the video deficit.
The video deficit. That's the finding that babies don't learn from screens the way they learn from live interaction.
It's been replicated dozens of times. Show a baby a demonstration on video, they don't imitate it. Show them the same demonstration live, they do. The brain at this age needs multisensory, contingent, three-dimensional input. Screens can't provide that.
Which brings us back to the guilt. Parents hear no screens and think I have no tools. But the tools are everywhere. They're just not electronic.
The tools are the kitchen, the grocery store, the cardboard box, and the parent's voice. And I think that's actually the deeper message of all this research. The developmental necessities for an 11-month-old are almost impossibly simple. A safe environment, a few open-ended objects, and a responsive caregiver who's present but not performing.
Present but not performing. That's the phrase that should be on the parenting books.
It's the opposite of what social media parenting culture tells you. Instagram parenting is all performance. The elaborate sensory bins, the themed activities, the developmental milestone tracking. But the science says that stuff is for the parent, not the baby.
Let's address the parent's boredom directly, because I think that's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. The prompt says, even if you, the parent, are a bit bored. That's a generous framing. A lot of parents are more than a bit bored.
The boredom is real, and it's valid, and it doesn't make you a bad parent. It makes you a human with an adult brain who's spending hours in an environment optimized for an infant brain. Those two things are incompatible in terms of stimulation needs, and pretending otherwise is dishonest.
What do you do with that boredom?
You decouple it from the baby's experience. The baby is not bored. The baby is having a rich, developmentally appropriate experience. You are bored. Those are two separate facts. And you're allowed to address your boredom without feeling like you're failing the baby.
Podcasts, audiobooks, thinking through word problems, calling a friend on speakerphone.
All of those are fine as long as you're still responsive to the baby's bids. The baby doesn't need your undivided attention for 6 hours straight. They need your available attention, the ability to look up and connect when they signal for it.
There's a meta point here about the podcast listening scenario specifically. The prompt mentions listening to this podcast while walking in circles. That parent might feel like they're doing something for themselves at the baby's expense. but the baby is getting carried, which is vestibular stimulation. They're hearing the parent's voice occasionally when the parent responds to them. They're in a familiar environment with predictable visual input, and the parent is relaxed because they're listening to something interesting.
The relaxed parent is the key variable that gets overlooked in all the enrichment discourse. A stressed, guilty parent who's trying to provide perfect enrichment is probably providing a worse developmental environment than a relaxed parent who's half listening to a podcast while the baby bangs on pots.
Because the baby picks up on the parent's emotional state.
Infants are exquisitely sensitive to caregiver stress. Cortisol is contagious in dyadic relationships. If the parent is anxious about whether they're doing enough, the baby registers that anxiety even if they don't understand its source. If the parent is relaxed and responsive, the baby's stress regulation system stays in the optimal zone.
The guilt itself is developmentally harmful, independent of whatever activities you're providing or not providing.
That's a strong claim, and I want to be careful not to guilt people about their guilt. But the data does suggest that parental stress and anxiety about parenting quality is a bigger risk factor for suboptimal outcomes than the absence of enrichment activities. The thing parents worry about, not doing enough, is less harmful than the worrying itself.
Let's get practical. If a parent listening to this wants to change something tomorrow, what are the highest leverage moves?
I'd say there are three rules of thumb that capture most of what the research supports. The first is what I'd call the 20-minute rule. An 11-month-old can sustain interest in a single environment, even a kitchen, for up to 20 minutes if the parent provides 3 to 4 contingent responses per minute. A babble, a point, a smile, that's a spoon. Set a timer if you need to. Don't intervene until it goes off.
The parent's job during those 20 minutes is not to entertain. It's to respond to bids.
3 to 4 responses per minute is not a lot. It's a comment here, eye contact there, maybe picking up the object they're offering you. The rest of the time, the baby is doing their own cognitive work.
The second rule?
The one new thing per day rule. Instead of planning elaborate outings or rotating a dozen toys, introduce one novel household object each day. A silicone spatula, a cardboard box, a piece of fabric with an interesting texture. The baby's brain treats each of these as a full sensory experience, and it takes them days to exhaust the possibilities of a single new object.
One object a day. That's so much more manageable than the enrichment schedule people think they need.
It aligns with how the baby's brain actually processes novelty. They don't need a fire hose of new stuff. They need one new thing at a time, with space to explore it deeply.
The third rule?
The parent sanity hack. Use the baby's independent exploration time for your own parallel activity. The baby doesn't need your undivided attention. They need your available attention. The kitchen walking podcast scenario. That's not a parenting failure. That's optimal design. You're engaged enough to be responsive, distracted enough to be relaxed, and the baby is getting exactly what they need.
The thing Daniel was doing while he sent in this prompt, walking in circles, listening to the podcast, occasionally responding to the baby. That's not just okay. It's what the science recommends.
It's what the science recommends, and I think that's the most counterintuitive finding in this whole field. The guilt-driven enrichment model says you need to be doing more, constantly, with better toys in more interesting places. The data says you need to be doing less, more consistently, with simpler objects in familiar places, while staying relaxed and responsive.
Let me push on the limits of this. At some point, a baby does get bored. Maybe not at 11 months, but eventually. When does genuine boredom emerge, and what does that transition look like?
And it's where the developmental trajectory gets interesting. Around 14 to 16 months, a few things converge. Object permanence is fully established. The baby knows objects exist even when hidden, which means they can want a specific object that's not present. Memory systems mature enough that the baby can hold a representation of a desired activity and compare it to the current activity. And the prefrontal cortex develops enough to support basic forms of sustained dissatisfaction.
The capacity for boredom is actually a cognitive achievement.
Boredom requires the ability to represent what you'd rather be doing, compare it to what you're currently doing, and experience the gap as unpleasant. That's sophisticated cognitive architecture. An 11-month-old doesn't have all the pieces yet. A 15-month-old is getting close.
The parent who's worried about their 11-month-old being bored is worried about a problem that literally hasn't developed yet.
They're worried about a problem that their baby's brain isn't capable of having. And by the time the baby is capable of boredom, they'll also be capable of communicating it, pointing, vocalizing, bringing you objects, showing clear preferences. The communication catches up to the cognition.
That's reassuring in a very specific way. The thing you're anxious about isn't just unlikely, it's developmentally impossible.
Knowing that should, ideally, free up some mental bandwidth. The parent can stop scanning for signs of boredom in an 11-month-old because those signs don't exist yet. What looks like boredom, staring into space, quiet focus, repetitive actions, is actually the baby's brain doing exactly what it should be doing.
The blank stare as cognitive effort.
There's a really nice finding from the infant attention literature on this. When babies are in a state of quiet alertness, not actively manipulating objects, not vocalizing, just looking, their brains are often doing the heaviest processing. They're consolidating what they just learned, or they're building predictions about what's going to happen next. The zoned-out baby is often the hardest-working baby in the room.
The parent who sees their baby staring blankly at a wall and thinks, he must be so bored, is fundamentally misreading the signal.
They're applying an adult model of attention to an infant brain. In adults, sustained quiet staring usually means disengagement. In infants, it often means deep engagement. The behavioral signals are similar, but the underlying cognitive state is completely different.
Let's talk about the overstimulation trap, because I think it's the shadow side of the enrichment model. You mentioned the Harvard study earlier. Elevated cortisol in high enrichment environments.
The Harvard Center on the Developing Child study from earlier this year was really striking. They compared two groups of 11-month-olds. The high enrichment group had multiple toys rotated hourly, daily outings to different venues, structured activities scheduled throughout the day. The low variety, high contingency group had fewer toys, more predictable routines, and more responsive caregiver interaction without the enrichment scaffolding.
The high enrichment kids had higher cortisol,
elevated cortisol, and shorter attention spans. The researchers' interpretation was that the constant novelty was overwhelming the baby's stress regulation systems. They couldn't build stable predictive models because the environment kept changing too fast. Their brains were in a constant state of mild alarm.
Which is the opposite of what the parents in that group were trying to achieve.
They were trying to provide the best possible developmental environment, and they were accidentally providing a mildly stressful one. It's the enrichment paradox. More stimulation doesn't equal more learning, and past a certain point, it equals less.
This connects to something I've noticed about the parenting discourse online. There's this assumption that if some enrichment is good, more enrichment must be better. But infant brains don't work like that.
Infant brains work on a U-shaped curve for stimulation. Too little, and they don't get enough raw material for learning. Too much, and they can't process what they're getting. The sweet spot is in the middle. Enough variety to be interesting, enough predictability to be safe.
The sweet spot is a lot closer to boring kitchen walk than to daily museum trip.
Which is good news, because daily museum trips are exhausting and expensive, and boring kitchen walks are free and you're already doing them.
I want to return to something you mentioned earlier about the Alina Foundation study. 30-plus adult words per minute, correlating with twice the language processing speed at 24 months. That seems like a concrete target parents can aim for.
It's a useful benchmark, and I want to be clear about what 30 words per minute actually sounds like, because I think people imagine it's a constant stream of narration. It's not. 30 words per minute, spread across an hour, might be 2 minutes of active talking and 58 minutes of silence. It's not a high bar.
You don't need to narrate every cabinet you pass. You just need to talk to the baby periodically throughout the day.
The talking doesn't need to be educational. It doesn't need to be, this is a cabinet, cabinet starts with C. It can be, what do you think, should we have pasta tonight? Yeah, I think pasta too. The baby is learning the rhythm and turn-taking structure of conversation, not the semantic content.
The form, not the content.
At 11 months, absolutely. The content comes later. What matters now is the back-and-forth pattern. I say something, you respond, I respond to your response. That's the foundation of language, and it's built through contingent interaction, not through vocabulary drills.
Let's circle back to the specific scenario from the prompt one more time. Daniel's walking in circles in the kitchen. The baby's being carried. He's listening to this podcast. What should he do differently tomorrow, if anything?
the scenario as described is developmentally optimal. The baby is getting vestibular stimulation from being carried, visual tracking practice from moving through space, auditory input from the parent's voice and the environment, and social contingency from the parent's responses to their babble. The parent is relaxed because they're engaged with something interesting. The only thing I'd suggest changing is the guilt.
Drop the guilt, keep the kitchen walk.
Drop the guilt, keep the kitchen walk, and maybe, if you want to add one thing, give the baby a wooden spoon to hold while you walk. Now they've got tactile input and an object to manipulate, and you've just upgraded an already good experience.
The wooden spoon as developmental optimization.
It's always the wooden spoon.
Let's talk about what happens when the baby does start to show genuine boredom, that 14 to 16 month window you mentioned. Because I think a lot of parents listening with 11-month-olds are going to hit that transition in a few months and wonder what changed.
The transition to toddler boredom is a whole different episode, honestly, but I'll sketch the outline. Around 14 to 16 months, you start seeing clear signs of preference and frustration. The baby will reject a toy they used to enjoy. They'll bring you objects to communicate what they want. They'll protest when an activity ends. This is when parents need to start introducing more structured choices and slightly more complex play.
That's not the problem Daniel has right now.
It's not. Right now, at 11 months, the problem isn't the baby's boredom. It's the parent's guilt about a problem that doesn't exist. And the best intervention for that guilt is understanding what's actually happening in the baby's brain.
Which we've now spent the better part of an hour unpacking.
If a listener takes away one thing from this, I hope it's this. Your baby's brain is designed to learn from the world as it is, not from the world as you curate it. The kitchen, the grocery store, the wooden spoon, your voice responding to their babble. That's not plan B. That's the whole plan.
The best thing you can do for an 11-month-old is be present, but not performing. Your boredom is a sign you're doing it right.
If you need to listen to a podcast to get through the kitchen walk, that's not a compromise. That's a strategy.
All right, I think we've covered the developmental science, the outings, the toys, the daily experience, and the guilt. Let's pull it together with some concrete takeaways.
If you're a parent with an 11-month-old and you've been feeling the guilt spiral, here's what the research actually supports. First, the 20-minute rule. Your baby can sustain interest in a single environment for up to 20 minutes if you provide 3 to 4 contingent responses per minute. That's a smile, a comment, eye contact, picking up the thing they're offering. Set a timer. Don't intervene until it goes off. Let the baby lead.
Second, the one new thing per day rule. Instead of planning elaborate outings or rotating a dozen toys, introduce one novel household object each day. A whisk on Monday, a silicone spatula on Tuesday, a cardboard box on Wednesday. The baby's brain treats each object as a full sensory curriculum, and they need days to exhaust the possibilities.
Third, the parent sanity hack. Use the baby's independent exploration time for your own parallel activity. Podcasts, audiobooks, thinking through work, folding laundry. The baby doesn't need your undivided attention. They need your available attention. The kitchen walking podcast scenario is not a parenting failure. It's optimal design.
Fourth, this one's more, but I think it's the most important. Audit your guilt triggers. Notice when you're thinking I should take him to the museum or I should be doing more. Replace those should statements with is statements. He is learning from the kitchen floor right now. She's getting vestibular stimulation from being carried. They are building predictive models by watching the same cabinets go by. The guilt is the only thing in the equation that's not serving anyone.
If you do all of that and you're still bored, that's fine. Your boredom is valid. It doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. It means you have an adult brain that needs adult stimulation, and you're spending time in an environment optimized for an infant brain. Those two things can coexist. You can be bored, and your baby can be thriving.
The science says parents are already doing enough. The guilt is the thing that needs to change, not the parenting.
That's probably the most important thing we've said all episode, so I'm going to let it sit there.
Before we wrap, I do want to flag something about where this is all heading. The baby enrichment market, the subscription toy boxes, the developmental apps, the baby classes grew 34% in the last 2 years. That's a lot of money being spent on a problem that, from a developmental perspective, doesn't exist at this age.
It's being driven by parental guilt, not by developmental need. The marketing says your baby deserves the best start. The science says your baby needs you, a wooden spoon, and a grocery store. The gap between those two messages is where the 34% lives.
It's a guilt tax.
It's a guilt tax, and the people paying it are parents who are already doing enough.
I think the open question we should leave listeners with, and maybe this is a future episode, is what happens when the baby does start showing genuine boredom? That 14 to 16 month transition where object permanence and memory mature, and suddenly the wooden spoon isn't cutting it anymore. What does the toddler boredom landscape look like, and how should parents navigate it?
That's a rich topic, and the research on toddler attention and boredom is actually quite different from the infant literature. Different brain systems, different behavioral strategies. I'd love to dig into that.
Something to look forward to. For now, the message for parents of 11-month-olds is pretty clear. You're doing fine. Better than fine. The kitchen walk is enough. The wooden spoon is enough. You are enough.
If you need to listen to a podcast while you do it, we know a good one. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1780s, a Mongolian monk in the Gobi Desert constructed a mechanical prayer wheel that used polished obsidian lenses to focus moonlight onto a series of brass gears, creating what may have been the first optical mechanical computer designed to calculate lunar cycles. Though it was destroyed by a sandstorm before it could be fully tested, and only a single sketch survives in a Russian archive.
I write?
That was. I have questions about the obsidian lenses, but I'm going to save them.
You always have questions about the obsidian lenses.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running, and thanks to everyone listening for spending part of your day with us. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll be back soon. Until then, enjoy your kitchen walks.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.